Welcome to the Tej Talks podcast. Forget the property celebrities. We speak to relatable people with fascinating journeys, just like you. Hosted by Tej Singh, we bring you new stories, life-changing deals, and expert advice every week.
Hello, everyone, and greetings to all our listeners all over the world. Thanks so much for tuning in. Now, on this week's episode, we have Tom Henderson. You may recognize him from Facebook, some of his pictures that he's put up, some of his marketing and his personal branding. And also, he was in the YPN magazine. So, yep, another celebrity on the Tej Talks podcast. And he talks about how he came straight out of university, bought some singlets, refinanced, got all his money back out, and kept doing that with no education on property, no experience, and no one really to mentor him. So he took a lot of action with not a lot of thinking, not a lot of over, you know, analysis, and he got some great results. And then he moved on to multi-lets, four-bed multi-lets specifically. He flipped one to an investor in Hong Kong, made £38,000 worth of profit. Wow. So we also talk about kind of entrepreneurship, what it means to have money and be free, things he likes to do in his spare time, how to keep and maintain a good relationship with builders, and also just the kind of trials and tribulations of his journey to become, you know, financially free, what he's looking at next. It's a really, really interesting one. And I think if you're listening to this and you're in university or you're sort of in education potentially, you know, this is a really, really inspiring story to kind of take action and get yourself out of where you are. As usual, please, please, please leave a review on iTunes or the podcast app. This content is absolutely free. I've also got some free ebooks, which are co-written with some of the people on the podcast, like how to rent to rent, how to do service accommodation, how to deal package, etc. If you go to tej-talks.com/ebooks, or just go on the website, you'll find a link there. But yeah, leave a review on the Facebook page or iTunes if you are loving the content. Thank you very much. Tom Henderson, you know, it's a real pleasure to have another celebrity on the Tej Talks podcast. You have been in your Property Network magazine, which is an awesome magazine. And if people, you know, are following you on Facebook, they may recognize you from taking pictures in front of cool things, such as a shutter with some wise words on it, and in front of a guy in a shop window. So I think you've definitely got an interesting social media profile, and it's kind of one that I guess led me to you after reading your story in YPN. So Tom, firstly, how old are you?
I'm 24. It's great to be here, by the way, mate. Thanks for having me. And yeah, them photos, if anyone wants to know about those photos, they're in Dublin. Go to Dublin. It's an awesome place. But yeah, I'm 24, Tej.
Amazing. And you've done a lot in property, you know, more so than I think a lot of people can, you know, think can be done. And, you know, your age is important, but at the same time, it doesn't matter because someone could be 70 and still have 20, 30 years ahead of them to do whatever they need to do. But I think it's important just to see how much you've done so early on in your life. So before you got into property, what were you doing with yourself?
Well, I've always kind of been quite, I hate the word entrepreneur. Everybody claims to be one nowadays if they go and do a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But I've always been quite entrepreneurial. I've always tried to find a way of making my own money. Back at university, I was kind of importing products from China, selling them on Amazon, set up a cleaning company. I've done all sorts, loads of little bits and bots. And I've never really, before property, I was just dabbling. I was at college, at university. And I started quite young. I started around 17, 18. So there wasn't really a kind of a pre-property story as such.
Mm. And then, so when did you leave university?
I left university about 3 years ago now. About 3 years ago. And since then, it's kind of really taken off. I started with sourcing, as everyone does. I started single lets when I was younger. Then obviously you go on these courses, you realize that there's a whole world out there to do with property. It's not just what everybody thinks it is, of buy it, get, save up some money, put it into a property, get the rental income. There's all sorts to do. So I started kind of with sourcing and went from there, really. Sort of finished university 3 years ago. And it seems like yesterday, Tej, honestly, it's flown by.
But so how did you, I know you were, you know, I know you don't like the word, but you were entrepreneurial during university. You made your own money. You had your own kind of businesses. What then made you say, okay, property is now what I'm going to get into. I'm not even going to consider a job. Like, I'm not even going to look at security as such. I'm going to go straight into property. And why property?
I don't know, really. I mean, it's just kind of the natural progression for everybody. You see the likes of Homes Under the Hammer TV shows like that, and you see the kind of the possibilities that can, and the money that can be made in property. So I think it was just more a natural progression. I bought my first house very young, absolute wreck. Redid it up, refinanced, and realized you could draw a lot of the capital out. And from then, really, it kind of opened your eyes to why can't you just rinse and repeat this process?
And how did you manage to afford buying a house so young? And I know you're based in the north. Whereabouts are you based?
Yes, Sheffield Way, so South Yorkshire.
So prices are definitely a lot cheaper than where I'm in London. But even then, how did you manage to afford that kind of straight out of uni?
So I had some saved up money anyway from my cleaning company and other kind of ventures. Borrowed a little bit of money off family. And obviously the property was exceptionally cheap, very, very cheap, put in an absolute ridiculous offer and it got accepted. And then I had to go in and refurb it, and I didn't have a clue what I was doing. So did that, refinanced it, paid back everyone I owed money to, and just repeated the process again and again.
Wow. And did you have any like formal education or read any books like during this or before this?
Nothing. My dad he's quite handy, he used to be a heating engineer in his youth, and he knows generally how to do all these trades things. So I had him come and literally show me what to do, all kind of from doing the joinery works to doing the pipe work to painting and decorating. I was an absolute amateur. I didn't have a clue what to do. So I had him kind of on my back, helping me a little bit, coaching me as such on how to do it.
Wow.
But yeah.
So, I think a lot of people, the natural thing is, okay, want to get into property, let me do a course, because there's obviously, like tens of different courses, all the marketing everywhere, all the promises of, Gucci shoes and fame and everything. So I think that's become quite natural, but I think you and me are similar in that sense where it's like, actually, we can do this ourselves. And, there's plenty of education out there that is free, and there's plenty you can do yourself. And you've kind of proven that, and people will realize that as we talk more about your portfolio. So you bought that first house, and then do you remember the figures for it in terms of purchase price, refurb, rental?
Not that far back. I know as I bought it, it was very low. The market started increasing, because the refurb took a long time, put it that way. I can't remember the post-refurb valuation, but it pretty much was all money out within reason. Rented for £450 to £500 per calendar month. Just basic single let, two up, two down.
And how have you progressed since then? So I know it's been a couple of years, but like, talk me through, I guess, like your progression since then.
So I did that another fair few times on kind of these two streets because I knew the model worked. So it was two identical streets, same properties. If you've seen all these kind of these old Victorian terrace houses, they are the exact same layout when you go inside. So just rinsed and repeat multiple times on these streets, doing the same thing, buying for roughly the same price, doing the same general refurb, revaluing at the same price. And then only around a year and a half ago, I actually went on a course and I found out about sourcing, about multi-lets, HMOs, all that type of thing, because I didn't know that existed. And that's when I started kind of changing the model I was doing. So some of these single lets, what I was looking for, they were in prime positions for multi-lets. So I then started venturing into the four-bed multi-let area, which is where I really, really like. I kind of specialize in a little bit at the moment.
And which course was that?
Are we allowed to mention training providers?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, sure. I'm not kind of, there's loads of alternatives out there. But it was Progressive's Masopi. So I went on there kind of like 3 day, signed up to the deal packaging course. It was good. I learned a fair bit. I think it's a lot better now though. The content's a lot better. But it was that Masopi. It just opened my eyes to the different possibilities within property, all from commercial conversion to sourcing to new builds to everything that I never thought was possible. You always think that you see these big developments going on thinking, oh, that's way out of my reach. I'll never do something like that. That's for people who are kind of 60, 70 years old who have been doing it 40 years. But it really broke it down and made you realize that it is easily achievable.
And that's interesting again, because like 2 points, I guess. One is that Mesopi is free. I don't know if it was when you went, but it basically is now.
Yeah, it was.
And that's sometimes all it takes is some event, some network, some people just to open your mind to what is possible. And then, interestingly enough, just going back to what you said before, that you know, you come out of uni, you bought a house, and you bought more, and you keep doing it. A lot of people, I guess, get stuck in the stage before that. And I've been in that stage where you're analyzing things, thinking things through, and it's just like, hold on, I've got this cash sitting here. Let me just buy something, give or take, as long as it's generally correct and you've done a good amount of research. Property can be quite forgiving, and I think you're a great example of just taking action, which we all need to do more of, right?
So I completely agree. I think people can analyze too much, whereby they don't actually take any action. And I've seen that, unfortunately, through kind of seeing the same people at these courses going month after month, year after year, and not actually just going, you know what, put my money there, let's give it a go and trying something. I think they kind of hide behind that sense of I'm actually doing something by attending these courses.
Yeah, 100%.
It's a shame, really, because you've got to go out there and you've got to actually do it and just go completely headlong after you've done your due diligence and really go for it. What's the worst that can happen if you've done your research to a suitable standard?
Yeah, no, of course. These course junkies, an interesting breed. So, you know, in terms of, so you bought a few properties, you were making some passive income from them, you kind of looked at multi-lets. Why did you choose like deal packaging when, you know, each deal makes you what, between 2 to maybe 5 grand? Let's just average figures here. But you were buying stuff, you were having a passive income, and you were doing quite well in terms of building an asset and wealth. What made you want to kind of, maybe in some people's views, take a step back to sourcing before you then carried on building your portfolio?
So obviously, deals come hard to find, really, especially on the market, because you've got every kind of, you've got Mrs. Smith down the street who watches Homes Under the Hammer, and she's happy to go do a flip for £5,000. You've got a lot of people contending for on the market properties. The way I structure it, so my own money, I source for investors, I've got JV partners, and I borrow finance. You've got all these different avenues of finance, yet the deals aren't there. So if I was to set up a steady stream of properties coming through, I'm never really going to be without available properties to purchase. So that's why I source, really. And then you've also got that cash flow injection coming into the business, really, because you can do all these property projects, but most times you leave fair amount of finance in. So there's only so many you can do before all your capital is tied up. So you do need a high profit generating part of the business.
That's interesting. And that's a really smart way of thinking about it. Cash is king and queen. So I think you've kind of filled that void and that gap that people normally reach and then look back and say, oh, I'm now out of cash. I didn't do anything about it. What am I going to do? Whereas you've said, I'm going to reach that point, but it's going to take a lot longer because I'm increasing my cash flow, which is key to any business. So that's really smart. And you know, when you're sourcing, what kind of, I don't know, you know, finding deals, like you said, is hard, full stop. So what kind of techniques could you share with us that you use to source great deals for your investors without giving your secrets
my
away?
Secrets away. I wish I had some secrets to give away, Ted. There aren't really that many secrets when it comes to it. It's just consistency, consistency, consistency all the time. Your general stuff, such as putting banners up on properties you own or doing kind of direct to vendor marketing. Getting in with an estate agent is a very good one. I do think it's very kind of underutilized by a lot of people, purely because if they come, literally, they get property on the market, it's in your area, it's for your certain kind of target price, what you're looking for, they'll give you a call straight away before going to anybody else. If you can get yourself into that position, you're winning every day of the week.
And how do you get yourself into that position with estate agents? Because it's a bit of a dark art to most.
It is. I think it's just being genuine with them. Don't go in with a big eye arm kind of beating on your chest going, I'm going to buy everything you've got, because they're going to look at you and think, who's this arse walking and thinking he knows it all? If you just walk in and say, look, this is the type of property I'm looking for, I do have funds available, or I can have funds available if the deal fits, and just be completely open with them. So at the end of the day, they're people too. They are exactly like you and I. They just chose a different career path. So if you do that, and if you go on a viewing and it's not right, tell them why it's not right, because they need to report back to the vendor, as in why people aren't purchasing their property. So if you can provide them with kind of a bullet point list of things which you think are incorrect with the property or why it's not worth what it is, it makes their job a hell of a lot easier. So they like you a lot more.
Yeah. And that sort of thing, you know, I guess also comes naturally in a way where you're like, oh, it's not right because of this. But I guess at first when you're kind of intimidated and you're interviewing and you think the agent knows it all, you kind of maybe will shy away and not give them the kind of bullet points and detail that, you know, like you said, will help them, because you help them, they're going to help you, the law of reciprocity.
Exactly.
Naturally. Yep. Okay. And then, so what does your portfolio look like now if we zoom out and look at it from the top?
Single lets, obviously, from the beginning, but it's mainly multi-lets now. So I mainly concentrate on four-bed multi-lets purely because I like the exit strategies. So you're not over-leveraging on kind of an asset and commercially valuing it. So if in the future anything was to go wrong, HMO demand was to drop off a cliff, whatever, you're kind of lumbered with a commercial asset that you're over-leveraged on and you can't sell on. So the way I do it is four-bed multi-lets. They are valued on bricks and mortar. The majority of the time, there's only one en-suite or no en-suites, four-bed, one bath, purely because the exits are lined up. So in the future, if HMO demand drops off a cliff, you can sell it on the open market. So take the locks off the doors, furniture out, it becomes a single let. You can sell it on the open market. You can put a buy-to-let tenant in there. You can sell it to an investor as a kind of a buy-to-let or a mini multi-let. So that's kind of why I concentrate on those. So going back to kind of my portfolio at the moment, it mainly consists of four-bed multi-lets, and it is ever-growing. Fingers crossed it grows a lot more this year.
Mm. And what sort of net income, like profit-wise, in your pocket are you getting every month from your portfolio?
So off each one, after voids, maintenance, bills, and kind of the whole works, it's normally between £700 and £800. I'm looking at trying to push that up slightly, using things like thermostats, which are smart landlord thermostats, and just increasing the room rent really by doing it to a really, really high spec.
Mm.
So making them look like boutique rooms.
Okay. And so that's a pretty nice passive income if we do sort of 700/800 times by four. That's pretty decent, right? Now, how long has it taken you to go from sort of zero to where you are now?
So my first multi-let, I sold to a Hong Kong client. It sold March of last year. So since then, really, it's kind of taken off because I've kind of nailed down the model, really, what areas work, what numbers work, and what refurbs entail. So I can just run the numbers constantly, find the projects which work, and go from there.
Hmm. So this, would you say, like, you bought your first multi-let, what, like a year ago or two?
Yeah, I'd say about a year ago. Okay. It completed roughly around a year ago. It was rented for about 3 months and then sold.
Okay, so that's quite a quick time frame to achieve that kind of cash flow. So that's pretty awesome. Now, have you bought these multi-lets with your own cash or have you used investor money?
So it's different ways I do it, Tej. So obviously, your own capital, that's number one. If you can with your own cash, do it with your own cash. Brilliant, because it's all yours then. You're not owing it out. Other ways are JV partners. So I partner with people who have got cash, but not necessarily the knowledge all the time. And I source the deal, have the refurb teams, do all the back-end work, kind of know the numbers. They just provide the finance. After it's refinanced, whatever is kind of left in the asset is debited to them if the property is ever sold in the future. Any equity kind of gained is then split 50-50. And then the rent split 50-50 straight into the account from there. Otherwise, I'll borrow money on a set return, so 8-10% per annum, 6% per project, or 1% per month on short-term lending.
Okay, and how do you find these investors?
Increase your social profile, really, as I'm sure you know, kind of coming from a marketing background, isn't it? It's increasing your social profile, getting your name out there, just being genuine, really. Just pushing, going to networking meetings, meeting people, talking to them, just getting your name out there and telling everybody what you do.
Hmm. And, you know, going back to that HMO that you sold to a Hong Kong investor, and everyone's going to be wondering, how did you find the Hong Kong investor?
So through networking, really. You meet people, you get connected. And then, you kind of do something for one person, it kind of cascades on, they know people, and it grows and grows. And then, you get a kind of good database of people who are wanting to work with you.
And what was the profit on that flip?
So that one was after all expenses, so solicitor costs and everything, it was around 38,000.
Okay. And was that a case of you knew where the HMOs worked, you basically sourced it, did the refurb, purchased it, and then I think you tenanted it for a little bit, and then you basically sold it on as like a ready-made investment for someone, right?
Pretty much on a yield basis. I mean, that one was quite a funny one because it was purchased initially to be a single let, and it was very, very motivated seller. The negotiations were going on for around 6 months because I was kind of persistent. I wasn't going to go past this certain threshold. And he was not wanting to sell and not wanting to sell. But then he got to a really desperate position whereby I offered to pay for his solicitor fees and agency fees, and I'll literally take it now. So yeah, it sold really. And so initially it was going to be a single let. I only found out about kind of multi-lets around halfway through the refurb when all the first fix had been done. So we changed what we were doing. I thought, you know what, why not? Let's just do it into a multi-let. So it kind of went from there. And then, yeah, it became a multi-let, tenanted out, and then sold to a Hong Kong investor.
And I mean, do you think that is a strategy in itself? Not necessarily to Hong Kong investors, but do you think there's a strategy for people like you and I to who have the knowledge, have the teams, and potentially the fundings to, you know, make HMOs and sell them on as ready-made investments?
I definitely think there is, especially in the market we're in at the moment, because a lot of people, they just want high yielding assets, places to put their money to generate further income instead of having it in the bank. My rule of thumb is obviously four beds. They are residentially valued on bricks and mortar. You're going to be selling them for a slight premium because they're already kind of turned into multi-lets. They're already tenanted. They're already cash flowing. So if you can sell them with a slight premium to an investor whereby they're not necessarily over-leveraging too much, it's a win-win. So I definitely think there is a market there.
And, you know, when it comes to investors, what do you think it is about you that makes people say, all right, Tom, here's my money, go for it?
I wish I knew. If I knew what it was, I'd bottle it up and sell it. I don't know, really. I think it's just how genuine I am with the realities of it, that I've been there. I've gutted properties myself. I know kind of everything what's entailed. I'm honest when problems come up and how to resolve them issues. Because nothing is ever kind of smooth, is it? We both know that. You're always going to kind of hit snags as you go proceed through the property. But I think it is just being genuine, being completely genuine with clients, with investors about what is achievable. Because a lot of these kind of these people, sources they call themselves, in air quotes, they go out, they find a property on the market, they underestimate the refurb, overestimate the rental value, and stick on $6,000 sourcing fee and hope for the best. People like that, they're just in it for the short game. They're not in it for the long term to develop relationships with investors. So I think just being genuine about what is achievable in that area, that kind of brings people towards me.
And I think that's, you know, in a nutshell, that's kind of what every single podcast guest has basically said. It's that being genuine, being yourself, being honest, being open and transparent, like in any business, is going to give you that relationship. Thinking about the long game is going to give you that investment. And it's quite difficult to, I think it'd probably be quite difficult for listeners to like internalize that. And that sounds weird because being natural and honest should be our natural behaviors. But I think everyone looks for something tangible, like, oh, is there a behavior we can do, or words we can say, or like, you know, something we can put on Facebook? But actually, as you and everyone else has said, it's kind of boils down to just being yourself and being honest. So for anyone listening, just be you but show people you. You know, like Tom said, it's about having that social profile and that social proof. So Tom, on your Facebook, you said you're a marketing nerd. What does that mean?
So university, I did a business marketing degree. I just love everything marketing, to be honest, mate. Systemization, kind of A-B split testing, finding out the best ways of generating further money, really. So where can I put my money to make the most money? Anything marketing, I love. A book you might have read, actually, it's called, I think it's The Boron Letters by Gary Holbert. That is probably the single, it's copywriting, so it's kind of connected with marketing. But if you haven't read that, or anybody who's listening to this, that is probably one of the most interesting books you'll ever read. Because this guy was one of the best marketers of all time. I can't remember what he did now. But it was back in kind of the 80s and 90s, and he made absolute millions from just copywriting and direct mailing, really. If you haven't read that, or anybody else, definitely read that.
Oh, I've just written that down. I'm definitely going to look that up. I love books on copywriting and marketing. So
it's incredible.
What do you think property investors are lacking in the marketing and sort of personal branding arena that they could be doing more of, perhaps?
You nailed it on that. Personal branding, really. Too many people try to be what they perceive to be professional and kind of successful. Don't be that. People don't want that. People just want somebody to be themselves, whether that is swearing all the time, whether that is you're just a trade, but you know what you're doing. Just play on who you are. Don't try and be the next Rob Moore or Simon Zutz or anyone like that. Just be yourself. I think too many people try to be unauthentic, really, and not themselves.
Mm. That's very interesting. There's a guy on my podcast called Craig Mitchell. I don't know if you've seen him on Facebook.
Actually, we're all going for a curry.
well, there we go then. So he's a trades kind of by trade and from back in the day, and a lot of his pictures on Facebook are him on site fixing stuff with a cup of tea down the pub, whatever. He's just literally documenting his life, and he's raised £1 million in JV Finance. Then you've got other people who will be in suits, will be off site, will have nice glossy videos, who've also raised hundreds of thousands or millions. And it just goes to show that it really doesn't matter who you are. It's just that you're showing who you are to the people in some shape or form. And Facebook is so powerful, right? And on that, when you were in the YPN magazine, did it sort of do anything for your credibility afterwards? Did you get more investors? What was the after effect?
Initially, not much. I think it is more just adding to that social proof, adding to that credibility. Initially, I didn't really get many people messaging me, but as kind of months went on, I got more and more people interested in what I do, finding out how I do what I do, and asking if I've got any deals, really. So it did increase that investor database. It's just a matter of, it's another thing to add that, look, I know what I'm on about. You can see it here. Just social proof, Tej. That's all it is. And it was great to be featured in it. Me and Am had a good chat about skiing for about half an hour and then an interview for about 20 minutes.
Sounds like a nice balance there. So is skiing one of your passions? Is you know, and I guess this leads to my next question, which is, you know, property can give us passive, in air quotes, income and allow us freedom and time to do whatever we want. What's your sort of why? What are you doing because of property?
Right. Skiing, I do love skiing. I think it's kind of like the only, my brain never turns off, constantly going 24/7, which I think is kind of a little bit of why we do what we do. It's kind of a curse and a blessing at the same time of entrepreneurial people. Skiing is the only place when you're standing at the top of that mountain, looking over everything, that I can really switch off. So I do absolutely love it. That is probably one of my passions. In regards to other passions, I don't really have many. I like to go to the gym quite a lot. I say that I haven't been this year yet or in the past couple of months. So I need to really kick myself up the arse there. But I enjoy doing that. I got a new little puppy as well, Spencer. He's only about 9 months old.
He's
now.
He's so cute, everyone. Go to Tom's Facebook.
He is the cutest little thing. but yeah, I love taking him for walks. When I was younger, I used to think, oh, when I get money, I'll do this. You know, when you do kind of get the ability to buy things or do this or do that, you don't want to do any of it. It's more about the things which money don't buy, such as taking your dog for a walk or kind of going and seeing your mates down the pub or going to watch rugby at Twickenham. It's not excessively expensive things. And I think that's kind of what the aim is. It's more the freedom and the choice than the money.
Absolutely. I think I see money as a vehicle to have that choice and freedom. And I think, you know, one of my business partners said to me the other day, he was like, you know what, Tej, if there was another zero at the end of my bank account, I really wouldn't be any happier. And that's kind of profound, because most people would say another zero, that's another zero. Like, that's a lot. That's, you know, Lamborghini money. But actually, when you kind of have that, I guess, epiphany or that moment, and I've had this before where you actually think, hold on a minute, the money's not the aim. You know, add some more money to my account is not going to make me happier. But what it will afford me and the luxury of time and freedom is so much more powerful and important than literally just, you know, a £5 note in your pocket. You know, living a good life doesn't, well, okay, good life is very subjective, but, you know, it doesn't have to be expensive. Unless you want to live like P. Diddy, then obviously you need to have a couple mil in the bank. But generally speaking, you know, it's kind of, things are affordable. And that's so interesting that, like, you've had this kind of epiphany so early on in life, because it means you have the rest of your life to enjoy what the money will give you, right?
Exactly. I mean, I couldn't agree more with what you've just said. It's more about the small things. It's the ability to sit at home on a Friday night and order a takeaway and not have to worry about it. It's things like that. What's it going to be? 20 quid? It's not going to bust the bank, but it's the ability to do all those little things and not think about it, which is the goal, really, the main goal. Not having a Lamborghini on the drive, a Jaguar F-Type next to it. I mean, those things would be awesome, and that is kind of what the majority of people aim for. But when you get to that position, are you really going, and all kind of that kind of tribulations you've had getting that money, are you going to want to spend that money on things like that, or are you just going to want to reinvest it? Most of the time you get to that point and you do just want to reinvest and create further wealth and further kind of as passive as you can get income.
It's kind of like the entrepreneur's curse, you know. We aim for that passive income, freedom, and that lifestyle. We get all of it, then we're like, I'm bored now. Let me reinvest it. Let me get more properties. Let me do more businesses. And then we just keep doing that.
Yeah.
And then talking about it.
There's a big investor up near me who has been doing it, I think, since about 2001, 2002. So the best part of 20 years. And every single year he says, that's it. I'm selling up. I'm not buying any more properties. The next thing I see, he's gone and bought a new commercial property and he's turned it into 20 flats or something like that. It's definitely a curse.
it definitely is. And I guess it's just like hardwired or at least learnt wired into our brains that, like, this is how we're going to work. But I think, it creates success. And if we love it and it's, you know, yeah, it may not be passive and you may have to put hours in, but if you love those hours, you know, like I do with podcasting, for example, and it's not really a job. That's an interesting discussion. Definitely one to talk over a curry with. What are you doing next in property? What's the aim? Is it empire building? Is it lifestyle? What is it?
So my next goals, I love my four-bed multi-lets. I'm going to keep doing them as long as the deals come through and they stack, but I want to push onto bigger things. So one of my goals for the next 12 months is to either do a commercial conversion or at least get one underway, a new build, or get one underway. So like the bigger projects, they're pushing onto the next level. So that's kind of my next goal, really. And we'll see what comes from there, as well as systemizing my sourcing company and creating certain revenues, employing people, and getting it more systemized, really. That's about it.
Hmm. And you know what? Something interesting. Do you find that because you're young and you look young, right? Everyone can look at your Facebook and agree with me. Do you find that like some people, and I reckon maybe you don't, but people take you less seriously or believe things you have done less? I know we're in a world where, you know, you've got millionaires younger than us who are founders at like 19, but do you get that at all?
See, and not really now. Initially, I kind of had that mental block of, I'm only this old. Do I really know what I'm doing? When I've been walking into estate agencies, it was in the back of my mind, me thinking, are they taking me seriously? And me walking in with them thoughts, kind of, it made it true, really. It made them not believe me or not take me seriously, purely because I was thinking that myself. But no, I don't really... Sorry, Tej. I don't know whether you can hear all that noise, but loads of texts are coming through. Going back to what I was saying, I don't really believe that now. I don't think that's the case. I think it plays in my favour more than anything now, because people are looking at me and think, wow, he's kind of got that fire. He's got that drive to do well. I like this guy. I'm going to take him seriously, as opposed to somebody who's maybe in their 50s. They've kind of lived their life to a certain level, they've achieved, they've got money, they're kind of quite settled and comfortable. So it does work in my favour more so now.
Yeah, no, for sure. And what you said about the estate agents is like a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know. It's like when people you kind of see on the group say, oh, you know, like, what do I do when I go into an agency? They know more than me, they're the expert. And it's like, they definitely don't, and they're not.
They don't.
They never know more. But it's kind of like the stories you tell yourselves, like, oh, they're so busy, they just want commission. And actually, it's totally not like that. Like, phoning agents, speaking to them, yeah, it's kind of intimidating walking into the room and kind of doing it. But I don't know. I just think it's all about, you know, things are not, like, things are objective. We add the subjective perception and meaning to it. So just go in open-minded and, like, ready to, you know, work with them. You know, they don't work for you. They don't work, you don't work for them, but it's kind of a partnership in a way.
Yeah, you're still trying to achieve the same thing, really. They're looking to sell, you're looking to buy. You're both wanting the same thing. So you want to work as closely as possible to achieve that. At the end of the day, they are exactly the same as you and I. And I said that before. They are people who, they go home at night, they see the partners, the children, whatever. They sit down, they have a food, they watch a little bit of TV. They do the same daily routines that we all do. So that there's nothing to be scared or worried about. They are just people. And if you go in and just talk to them, normal, have a laugh and a joke, talk about the weather, talk about how Christmas has flown by, all the same things we all kind of connect with, you'll be completely fine. It is just a people game, as every business is.
Absolutely. And speaking of people, you've obviously done quite a few refurbs in your time. How do you find good, like, build teams, the ones you can trust and will do it to the standards you need and not rip you off?
If you do find out, Ted, let me know, please.
That's what you're here for, mate. Come on.
It's trial and error. It really is trial and error. I think people underestimate knowing what is involved in a refurb. I think that is so, so important at the beginning of your journey to learn that and not necessarily do it, but know kind of where each fix comes, where, how it's done right, even down to different types of skirting and architrave and how, like, kind of how much things should cost. Because I've had people come in and tell you a story actually about these heating engineers. So I was doing a refurb middle of last year. I wanted one ensuite. I wanted not even repiping, just kind of a few heat radiators moving, repiping to the radiators, new boiler fit and commission, ensuite, bathroom, everything fit. And they came in and they saw me pull up in kind of like a little bit of a flash car, private reg. I'd just been with investors, so I was dressed quite well. And they thought, okay, I could see them rubbing their hands together and dollar signs in their eyes. Walked them around. I said, look, guys, I just want to work with some good people who don't charge me the world, do the job well, do the job when they say they're going to do the job. So they were giving that all that kind of, yes, Tom, yeah, we're your guys, blah, blah, blah. So I gave it a couple of days. They got a quote over to me and they came back at £6,500,
huh?
Which is exactly, absolutely ridiculous. And I mean, Tej, I got it for less than half of that in the end.
Wow.
Easily. Not even hard to get it for less than half of that. Purely because they looked at me and thought, right, I'm going to take this kid for all he's worth. I can definitely tell you I didn't use them going forward at all. But I think it is just trial and error. Just know generally what's involved and just get people in, see the quality of the work, and trial them. Say, right, okay, how much is it going to be? Kind of stage payments and just go for it. I've had people this year who have done things completely wrong and caused me further work, but there's kind of another one ticked off the list that I'm not going to use again. So kind of just shortens it all down to people who you have got, who you can use and you've got good, reliable trades.
Absolutely. And I guess, yeah, trial and error, getting multiple quotations for the same thing, but cheap isn't always necessarily better. But, you know, you'll figure out which one is a realistic quote. And I guess also, you know, if you had someone like Tom or, you know, someone who's mentoring in that area who's done it, you can say, you know, would you lend me your build team? You know, would you project manage it for a fee? Would you refer me someone, recommend someone? Because, you know, yeah, we're all busy with our own projects, but at the end of the day, we're all getting there together. So, you know, there's definitely people who will borrow you their build team. I've asked three people and all three have said yes. So, you know, it's definitely something you can do. You know, let people like Tom make the mistakes for you, and then you can come and get the get the trials and errors.
Very pricey as well.
Well, exactly.
Another tip as well. I see a lot of people, they go and they want to get all these specialized trades for every single thing. And some of the big players I was talking to the other day on Facebook, or who I perceive to be big players from Facebook, and they were saying that they agree with me that you don't necessarily need to get every single trade for everything. Why would you pay excessive fees when you can just get a handyman to do a lot of the work and then get kind of your qualified trades to snag it afterwards? I've done that on multiple projects and it's really pulled the refurb cost down, purely because you're not getting X, Y, and Z priced X, Y, and Z. You're getting one guy to do a lot of the work You've got economies of scale on that, and you just get your kind of qualified trades in afterwards just to snag it, and it's a hell of a lot cheaper and the same level of work, same kind of quality of finish.
I like that. That's a very, very interesting tip, and I've seen people kind of recommending that on the groups, but it makes total sense. Yeah, I like that. That's a strong tip. And the next question is really broad, but you know, feel free to answer it in any direction you want. What are your thoughts on the market in your area being Sheffield?
Well, generally South Yorkshire, it's awful up here. Nobody come up here unless you invest in me. In all honesty, it's a little bit of a weird market at the moment. On the market, everything's definitely overpriced. I saw one the other day, which was the comparables proved it to be 85. And this property, which needed 20 grand's worth of work, was on the market for about 97 and a half. So it's definitely overpriced at the minute, which is why I'm concentrating more on off-market deals, because the agents don't go in and promise the vendor the world, and then they kind of get it set in their mind that the property's worth that much. So it's a little bit of a weird market. Hopefully it'll kind of cool down a little bit soon, but you just got to go with it, really. Just if the market's changing, you find a way to change with the market, which is why I'm approaching direct-to-vendor marketing a hell of a lot more than going through agents at the minute.
And when you say direct-to-vendor marketing, are you doing the standard leafleting? Are you doing targeted Facebook ads? What's your kind of approach?
Leafleting, direct mail, getting the HMO registers and writing to landlords seeing if they want to sell up. I actually looked at one last night, which was kind of finding out small independent bed and breakfasts in and around certain areas, trying to find kind of the contact details of the people within them and writing to them pretty much saying, look, I know you're running these B&Bs. It's a hard market at the minute with the likes of Airbnb coming on board, hotels.com, squeezing the margins for people like yourselves. If you ever want to sell up, then here's my number. Let me know. So I'm just about to trial that now. Fingers crossed, I get some good responses. If not, then we'll just kind of move on to the next idea.
I like that. I've written that one down for myself, actually. That's a good tip there. And is there an app or resource or platform or bit of technology you can't live without?
Google Drive. I live through Google Drive. You've got all your emails in there. You've got Google Word documents, all that kind of stuff. But it's the fact you can kind of interconnect people to certain areas as well. So honestly, Google Drive, I run everything within that. And it doesn't plug up your Mac either. It obviously keeps that going fast. CRM systems, I just use Podio. It's free. It's really user-friendly. You can kind of interconnect it with Zapier and loads of other apps. And it's easy. It's great. So you don't need to spend the world on kind of Infusionsoft and things like that, unless you're at a certain level, which obviously I'm not at yet. But Google Drive, Podio, they're kind of my two main things.
Amazing. I've just signed up to Podio, so I'll share my thoughts on that in another podcast once I've got to use it.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, Google Drive is...
If you need a hand with it, Ted, let me know, mate. We'll just go through it. It's really easy.
Awesome. Google Drive is also great. We use that at work. I know companies, huge companies who use it, which just shows how capable it is. Tom, this brings us to pretty much the end of the podcast. We just have the quickfire round left. So we definitely need to meet up and have a chat, mate, about marketing, about gym, about everything. So, you know, next time you're in London or the next time I venture past Birmingham, which I don't remember last time I did that. It's a bit scary out there.
I wouldn't advise it.
Yeah, we definitely need to meet up. So I'm going to hit you with a quickfire round.
Go for it.
What would be your top three tips for people who are new in property?
Okay, so number one, get educated. And that doesn't necessarily mean going and spending £30,000 on a course to kind of sit in a room and learn. It means go out and speak to people who are doing it, grab a few books off the internet and give them a read, join the Facebook groups. I've learned probably more in the Facebook groups than I have anywhere else, purely because it's people talking about things you want to learn. So that's kind of within get educated, that's what I'd do. Don't try to do too much at once as well. I can remember when I first kind of started the source thing, I was trying to do source rent to rents, commercial conversions, flips, new builds, HMOs, everything. And I didn't source anything because I was trying to cover too many areas and not really micro-niching on a certain thing. Whereas now I micro-niche on four-bed multi-lets. That is my specialty within certain areas. So if any property comes up, bang, I'm straight on it. To really kind of micro niche and try not to do too much at once, pick one thing and stick to it for at least 12 months. But yeah, that goes on to kind of my third one, which is niche. Just become the go-to person within that area for that certain type of product, whatever it is, whether you're a sourcer, whether you're HMOs, commercial conversion, whatever, become the go-to person for those.
Awesome. The Facebook one, definitely. I've learned so much from Facebook just by watching and commenting and reading and like, so definitely get in all the Facebook property groups you can, and you'll realize which ones are really good, and you can leave the ones that aren't, and you'll learn loads. So what are the biggest three mistakes that you've made, Tom?
Where do I start? Do you want to do another hour long podcast? First of all, understanding how long it takes to snag a property and kind of what's entailed. I think going into it, not really knowing what you're doing can be really disastrous. It goes back to what I was saying before, that if you do kind of buy your first project, I'm not saying go in there, gut it all, do all the works yourself, but pay very close attention to the trades and try and learn off them at the same time. Because I've made multiple mistakes from not keeping an eye on trades and that type of thing. Number two would be getting too friendly and breaking that professional barrier with certain tradesmen. I had one guy who used to kind of come in, make himself a cup of tea, chat to me about his life, this, that, and the other. It became too close for comfort, really. There wasn't that kind of that professional line there whereby he was falling behind in his work. Yet I felt too kind of matey to tell him, look, get your act together. This needs to be done. So I'd say become friendly, buy them a coffee from McDonald's or treat them to a beer on a Friday, but don't necessarily become matey with them unless they're getting the work done and still getting the work done to a suitable standard. And trusting other people's numbers, never trust other people's numbers, which goes back to what I said earlier, Tej, about one of the kind of sourcing agents just thinking, oh, a $5,000 refurb will do that house, when in reality it's 25. Always do your own due diligence on everything. Even if you've got off kind of a trusted sourcer, I always recommend to my investors, do your own due diligence no matter what. So that's kind of my three biggest mistakes, what I've not done and what I'd recommend, how to combat them.
Awesome. And what are your sort of next or most important three goals for the future? Personal life, career, property, whatever?
Yeah, sure. So kind of systemizing everything a little more. So this year has been, it's been really good for me. I've been exceptionally busy. I've been a bit of a busy fool at times, trying to kind of put out fires here, do that. So kind of coming into the new year now, I'm looking at systemizing everything, potentially taking on a mentor who has done what I want to do, and they can help me systemize everything. So that's what I want to do, really, outsource and systemize and grow the company, so I can work on it, not in it. Number two would be getting into big boy projects. So I want to push, like I said earlier, into either commercial conversions or new builds. So just where I see kind of the journey naturally progressing to. That's what I want to do kind of in the coming year. Definitely learn about them and potentially take one on. And then number three is just get my ass back to the gym, to be honest, mate. I've eaten so much over Christmas and drank so much, so I'm a little out of shape compared to normal. So, yeah, that's kind of my three goals for the next 12 months.
Awesome. I might have to hold you accountable to the last one there. I'll definitely be in your inbox nagging you. Don't you worry about that. And actually, just quickly, have you got your own networking event now?
So I did. As I say, I'm kicking that back up the arse this year. I did have meetings all over the country. I kind of let it slow down a little bit as I got busier and busier, and I had to pick what I concentrated on. Obviously, the one which generates the most money, you have to concentrate on, because that pays your bills, it puts a roof over your head. But this year, so the property youth, kind of property investors 30 and under, I will be setting back up and getting networking events going on again.
Okay.
So
awesome.
That's the goal.
Yeah, people look out for the property youth. Awesome, Tom. Well, look, thank you so much for your time. This has been an awesome podcast, and I look forward to hopefully meeting you at some point soon as well.
Definitely. Next time I'm in London, we'll go for a pint. Definitely.
If you like this podcast, connect with Tej on Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube for more great content.